Forge the Narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. This is episode 164. I don't know. We've done like three episodes while we're trying to fight through some technical stuff. I'll introduce some absolute champions. We're recording on a Friday night. I'm not even going to edit this, so I hope that it comes through the way it should be. Justin Troop and Andrew Whitaker.
Oh, baby.
The one Friday night I'm not out and drunk. Let's do this thing.
Right, I'm in and drunk. Ricky Addington and Chris Morgan.
Iron Man podcasting tonight. We're doing one take.
Round three, fight.
I really can't thank you guys enough. I mean, this really is. I mean, this is like the outside, you know, the social night, and everyone's here podcasting because that's how much it means. And I mean, I really appreciate you guys coming in. So like 11 o'clock, this is prime time.
11:30, well, but you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So what you need to do is write an iTunes review and say, they donated their Friday nights to me. This means so much. 5 stars.
That's how we care.
To be fair, and I just want to, like, you know, give me and Ricky and Justin and Paul a lot more credit than Chris deserves. It's only 9 where he is, so he could probably go out still. He's out in Utah. He doesn't deserve nearly as much.
Oh, man. I've got parenting responsibilities.
I don't want to hear that. Don't hit me with your Debbie Downer nonsense.
Just take them with you. It's like, that's how you get the ladies. Well, I mean, Gene Stealer Cults. I mean, we talked about this before on the last show, but this is, I think, really is going to have an impact on what we see on the tables. And I built a list, and I want to point out that I built the list incorrectly. And that's because of, you know, with the enthusiasm of building a new list with the rule books and everything, as you see it, you skip over things. So I want to point out one of the really cool kind of gotchas in this book when you're building the Gene Stealer Decurion.
What's the actual, like, formation?
Yeah, the formation. What's it? The Cult Insurrection Detachment?
Even if we knew what it was called, it wouldn't matter. Everyone's going to call it the Gene Stealer Decurion, so you might as well stick with that.
I'll stick with that. But there's a rule here, is that you cannot include more than one Patriarch, one Magus, or one Primus in the same Cult Insurrection Detachment. And that's a big deal, because a lot of the formations have those as your, like, it's either a 0-1 choice or it's a mandatory choice, so it really dictates what you can take. But outside of that, this is a pretty open Decurion. There is almost zero fat on this thing. You can take all power, all good stuff, all things that benefit each other in this detachment.
Yeah, there's 6 tactical squads to get through. So that's the best part right there.
There's not 6 titans. No Devastator Squad. No nothing. There's nothing you need to take weird in here.
The reality of the situation is this is a power gamer's dream come true, right? Like, it, you know, there's no heavy taxation. All of the kind of individual auxiliary choices or the core choices for Gene Stealer Cult are very streamlined. There's, you know, 2 to 5 units in each one. That's lots of flexibility, lots of options, and not a whole lot of heavy burdens. I mean, what Ricky just said was very true, right? If you're trying to run a Gladius, like, hey, hope you're strapped in to bring 2 dev squads and 6 tactical units. Like, never mind the assault guys who are, you know, even their moms don't like them. Like, there's not a lot of heavy taxes here. It's very streamlined, very, very kind of, like I said, power gamer's dream come true, because you get to pick the stuff that you want to build for your power list.
There's a couple cool things here that are army-wide special rules, and I want to talk about what it's called, the Unquestioning Loyalty. As a model with this special rule automatically passes Lookout Sir attempts and can even make Lookout Sir attempts when fighting a challenge. That sounds kind of innocuous. Maybe to some people sounds innocuous until you realize you can put a broodlord. It's not called a broodlord. It's called a patriarch or something. Whatever. You guys correct me.
Down with the patriarchy. Or wait, that's
but you can put it in a 20-man squad, and that dude's got 3 wounds on himself. And so you've essentially created a 23-wound combat monster.
Love it.
Yeah, I don't know what innocuous means, but that sounded good.
This is one of those cool, and I don't know how much playtesting they did. You know, GW catches a bad rap historically for not playtesting the models or their rules before they kind of send it into effect. But I think Gene Stealer Cult has some very interesting kind of sequential domino type effects. This this the rule that Paul just talked about with the lookout sir and challenges, and then there's a couple of relics that kind of dovetail with that nicely. One of which is if you're in a challenge, every round that you fight in a challenge, your opponent has to take a toughness test. And if he fails it, he takes a wound and he's minus to his statistics. So it's like, yeah, challenges are, you know, generally a way for, you know, beat sticky combat units to whittle through and target their wounds. But against a Gene Stealer cult, you're terribly punished for accepting a challenge. One, the guy is never going to get touched because he's going to look out sir everything in auto pass. And two, you know, if they have the right relics or take these certain special rules, you know, you could be taking toughness tests and be getting wounds with no saves allowed every round. Lots of cool little gimmicks like that, that a good player is going to be able to manipulate.
But we never actually talked about the relics in the 13 and a half other attempts that we've recorded this show. But I was actually like kind of thumbing through them. And they're not like overwhelmingly great, but God, are they fun.
We did talk about the good relics.
Yeah. You know, naturally, like the two that were specific to your kind of concept was pretty interesting. But we didn't talk about the one staff with like, it's like assault 10, poison 2 plus rending. Like that might be something kind of neat to think about with what the psyker kind of looking guy.
Let me go down the line here. This unquestioning loyalty, it factors in because a lot of the units have it. And so it's going to give some extra durability to all your character models. And that if you build it in such a way, that is pretty strong.
Almost all of the Gene Stealer cult HQ choices have unquestioning loyalty.
Yeah,
I think absolutely. I don't know of anyone that doesn't have it. Yeah,
right. And I think Justin may be talking about the staff of the Subterranean Master, which is an 18-inch strength 2 assault 10, ignore cover and rending.
Yeah, I got that one mixed up with the dagger of with the poison with the insta death. But yeah, that's fun, man. 10 shots,
ignore cover and rending can. I mean, it actually does a little bit of work.
Yeah, I think it gives you put that psyker kind of guy. What the Magus? Is that the name? Magus, yep. Magus.
Close enough.
Yeah, you throw
that him. That should cover most of the United States pronunciations.
Yeah. So you throw him in with that 20 block of dudes that resemble the IG guys, because they're kind of built out to be shooting, in my opinion. And then that adds some running shots in there, and that makes that little 20-man block a little bit more viable.
But just think of the units that rely on their cover saves more than their armor saves. I mean, even if you're shooting at some Ravenwing bikers, for example, that want their 2+ rerollable jinx save, even just denying them the opportunity to take that can do work for you.
I think so. That's a solid. That's one of the very solid relics to take.
Yeah, I'm not a mathematician, but 10 dice, you're getting a couple sixes.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you're going to get probably at least 3 on a good day, right? So with the Cult Insurrection Detachment, you get the ability to reroll your Patriarch and reroll as Warlord traits. Whatever. That's not the exciting. But the next rule.
No one was expecting that.
Yeah. All uprising generations in the making. An uprising generation in the making. All non-vehicle units in this attachment have the infiltrate special rule. Units that already have the infiltrate special rule instead gain shrouded special rule during the first turn of the game. In addition, you can add 1 to all your reserve rolls whilst your opponent must subtract 1 to all their reserve rolls. That is like getting 2 bonus traits right in one rule. I mean, that's pretty strong.
I really like that one.
The next one is numbers beyond counting. This is when you start to get really kind of beardy, like just on the very surface level. Each time a unit from this detachment arrives from ongoing reserves and is reinforced, you can return D6 models to the unit that were slain previously during the battle.
That's my favorite thing right there. Just if you don't kill, it's just like playing Necrons before. If you don't kill the whole squad, well, they're going to go away, they're going to come back, and you're going to potentially fill them all the way back up, and then you got to deal with them again. So,
yeah,
you got somebody like
cockroaches
there. Yeah, yeah. They just keep coming back, and it's got that swarm feel to them that Tyranids should have. And you know, that's the thing. If that
they are not Tyranids, Ricky.
I'm sorry.
They're Gene Stealer cults.
Have
I feel like Tyranids wish they were Tyranids.
Yeah, this is what Tyranids should be. you dedicate that one squad to finishing off, you know, these 5, Gene Stealers coming at you, and you don't do it. Well, guess what? You have to commit a whole other squad to shoot at that one guy just to keep him from coming off the table and then coming back with D6 of his buddies and then eating you next turn.
I completely
it's like
agree.
That guy who keeps inviting people to the party that you don't yes, want guys. To show. It's, who are these people?
It's a crazy serious thing. I mean, I've played now 3 games against Gene Steer Colt, and it is a serious thing. It shifts your entire target priority. Like, oh my God, that guy has one model left. And if I don't, you know, like I've shot a unit at him and I killed 6 of his buddies and he's got one model left. And I'm like, if I let that dude go back into ongoing reserve, he could show back up with his full squad and they could assault me out of reserve. And I'm like, yeah. I can't let that happen. I have to shoot him till he's dead. And it shifts the whole target priority. It's absolutely bananas the way it forces you to calculate, one, your target priority, two, your own unit protection importance, and three, positioning, because once those guys disappear, you know, they show back up wherever they want to on the board. And I get it, you know, if you roll a one, they have to walk on from your board edge. If you roll a two, they have to outflank.
We covered on the last show, that's not always going to be a detriment either. I mean, and there's time. Yeah, and that's just fine.
Right, exactly. But on a 3+, a 3 is I can basically, you know, poor man's infiltrate 9 inches away from a unit, from my opponent's unit. So I can show up anywhere on the board as long as I'm 9 inches away from an opposing unit.
And they can see you.
On a 3+. Yeah, they can see you, and I can still put them 9 inches away. And so it's like, you know, I have to kill these units. It is so hugely important. And one mission in particular, you know, Marked for Death is a very popular mission type where you select units to have to kill them.
And good luck with Gene Stealers.
That was literally my experience. I picked, you know, I picked 3 units and I was like, okay, Marked for Death, I'll get them. And they were, you know, a 4-man unit of the strength 6 guys and whatever it was, hybrid. Tyranids have these weird names, and I don't know which ones are which.
They're a combination of like 4 words.
Exactly. these hybrid neophyte rending claw gene stealer or something or others. Those guys over there, and I put
aberrant.
The alkaline aberrant neophyte.
Absolutely. And Price was just like, all right, cool. I'm gonna put them in ongoing reserve. You cannot shoot them this turn. Okay, fine. Then they walk on. Then he rolls, and he puts them in the very far corner. And they disappear and they show back up the next turn wherever I'm not and wherever I can't put damage on them. And it was just like, wow, that is an incredibly powerful mechanic to keep those particular units safe. And then the offensive capacity obviously kind of goes without saying. It's very, very cool and very, very strong.
Well, is it whack-a-mole for grown-ups?
This formation, the core is – one of the cores is on a brood cycle, which has an Akana word, which is a pretty strong HQ choice. 3 units of Acolyte Hybrids, 2 units of Neophyte Hybrids, 1 unit of Metamorphs, and 1 unit of Pre-Exchange Gene Stealers as your mandatory. You have a 0-1 Aberrance and a 0-1 Goliath Rock Grinder. The Rock Grinder, amazing model. I love it. It doesn't have a place in the army, in my opinion. But the rest of this stuff is all lean and mean business items.
Yeah,
they're all things that you want to have. Like, there are so many times where you have a compulsory thing where you're just like, what is the cheapest way I can bring this so it is the least obstruction to what I'm trying to accomplish? That doesn't happen here.
No, this is smartly built to take advantage of a lot of – I don't know. I mean, I want to say the intent is there, but it's to take advantage of some powerful stuff. And because of that disadvantage we talked about with only one – you know, one of the HQ choices per this host detachment, the Decurion-style detachment – The big thing that caught my attention is the Doting Throng is good, but I think the Subterranean Uprising is even better. And its requirements are 0-1 Primus, because you know you can't have multiple in the army. And then 1-3 hybrid Metamorphs, and then 2-4 Acolyte Hybrids, and then 0-3 Aberrants. This formation, I think, is incredibly strong. If you guys aren't familiar with it, I'll go and run it down right now. The Subterranean Uprising has 2 or 3 special rules on this detachment. One of them is infiltrate, so everything in the detachment gets infiltrate. Time to rise up. All the units in the Subterranean Uprising must infiltrate during deployment. Now, that's not a terrible thing, because it also goes on to say, and set up using the Cult Ambush special rules. Now, in case we haven't really covered it explicitly, you roll the Cult Ambush when you're deploying. That is, at deployment or in reserves. So you could technically deploy your entire army. Say you had 30 units and you rolled 36s or whatever. They could all be charging the turn that you deploy. Like first turn charges, charging from 3 inches away. That is incredibly strong. And it goes on further to say, when rolling on the cult ambush table for a unit in this formation, roll 2 dice instead of 1 and choose the result. The next rule is meticulous planner. If a unit in this formation has been joined by a primus, and this is very important, it's not a primus from this formation, it's just joined by a primus. Could be from another combined arms attachment, can be from wherever you choose. Joined by a primus, you can roll 3 dice instead of 1 when rolling on the cult ambush table for this unit and select any one of the results.
Now you brought up something that kind of confused me. You said that they have infiltrate and then they have the cult ambush. To me, that seems like there's a little bit of fun you can have there where you can infiltrate them so they're not on the board. Now you're in the infiltrate phase. You get to kind of mess with your opponent's head, see where he deploys.
And the list I built... it really, really capitalizes on this. And let me run down just kind of the bones of the list. Again, I built it with enthusiasm so that I had two subterra. I had like 4 primuses in this list, which you cannot do using the cult insurrection force or whatever it's called. But you can take multiple combined arms attachments depending on the environment that you're playing in. And it basically capitalizes on this acolyte hybrids. It's 80 points base for 10 of them. That is, in my opinion, amazing for the amount of attacks and war gear that you can equip them with, and the fact that you get to roll in this cult ambush at the beginning of the game. So essentially,
Paul Murphy is basically the Oprah of the hybrid master dudes.
You get a Primus.
You'll find a Primus.
Yeah, you can't do it the way I did, but you can build in multiple combined arms. You could take the insurrection attachment and then a couple of combined arms attachments, and then you're back in the business of rolling 3 dice. I'm going to go ahead and say the cheesy thing that I did in here was I added in Kodiaz.
Ugh.
And then a Psychana Divination detachment, or sorry, Psychana Division detachment with 3 commissars.
As cheese is implied.
Well, he's there hanging out with the Psychana Division. You know, he's just like overseeing, like, hey, why are you guys hanging out with these weird looking miners? You know, and then he's like, oh, I must leave to report what's going on, but not without ensuring that you get to go first and adding 2 dice.
I want to hate you so much for building that and then throwing in an Inquisitor, but you kind of justify it, and it almost makes me want allow it.
He was giving me crap in yesterday's recording for having an Inquisitor with a Blood Angels army.
Yeah, and
because, like, hey, look, I want to make it clear, Blood Angels don't hang out with Inquisitors.
Flesh Terrans don't hang out with Inquisitors.
Blood Angels, Blood period. Angels. They're like, you don't come to ball. You don't come here.
Well, I will say this, and this is, I refuse to like engage Paul in his shenanigans. Like, I'm just gonna slap Cody as in the Gene Stealer cult army because it's good.
I admit it. That you don't want to, you should not do that in friendly circles.
Whatever. That is what it's called, forcing the narrative.
Yeah, when we hang up this call, you are the one that has to look your wife in the eyes and tell her you're a man. Like, that's on you. Like, that's how, whatever you gotta do to sleep at night, that's fine. I'm not trying to tell you you're wrong. I will say this, though, from a competitive standpoint. What you heard last week on the show, what we're discussing tonight, you know, pre this comment and post. The reality of the situation is that Gene Stealer Cult is a meta shifter. It is. It is a fundamentally kind of competitive scene shifting release. And that's great. I have no complaints about that. It's not overpowered. These little stupid idiots died of bolter fire. We'll talk to that a little bit. I'll talk about that a little bit later. Where, you know, in ways to combat new Gene Stealer Cult, not overpowered, just fundamentally meta shifting.
Do not talk down on them anymore, Andrew, or you will get yelled at. I know this person.
I can witness. Now, Troop, you're the one who thinks they're garbage, so just don't come at me with that nonsense.
And he's getting territorial idiots, about his naysaying.
Exactly.
Those little idiots that died of bolter fire.
There's only room for one guy on this show to poop on them, and that's Justin Troop's job. 20% of this show has to hate on them. No, yes. But I will say this. A null deployment army is a hugely difficult thing for Gene Stealer Cult to deal with.
We are the 80%.
Do you really feel that way? And this is just a question. Do you think that they'd say, cool, you know how to play. All right, I cold ambush. I lurk into the shadows. Great.
Yeah, they kind of counter annul the play. Especially if they do like the whole like infiltrate then cult ambush crap. I think that there's a counter to null deploy. I think it's evening the playing field.
So to me, null deployment, there's no way for a Gene Stealer cult army to get off a T1 assault against a null deployed army, right?
I agree. Yep.
I have nothing on the table. Okay, so if you're a Gene Stealer cult player, you have to have something on the table, right? You're not going to lurk back into the shadows on turn one with your entire army. You have to have something on the table. That's how it is. And so if you're a null deployment army playing against Gene Stealers has the initiative when choosing the engagement, and if there's, I don't know, four units on the table, these Gene Stealer cult, they're not durable. They don't react. I mean, it's like Sean Connery in Hunt for October. They don't react well to bullets, right? Like they die very, very quickly. And so what they have for them is...
I love that you made that reference.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite movies.
Their durability is based on their capacity to choose their engagements and lurk out of range, their kind of redeployment ability. And if they're on the table and you get to land on them and shoot them, they wither away and die very, very quickly. And so I think that null deploy armies kind of got a boost. And then again, all of this is kind of my overarching point being that certain armies got a big boost because Gene Stealer cult is now in the world.
No, the fact that they exist is just good. And that's kind of where I'm going, is that it is very strong. It's incredibly strong. If you roll well or even just roll average and you can pad this, right? I mean, you can manipulate it a little bit. They are just – it's just good that they exist.
My first game against them, I played against Price, the guy who won Battlemaster at Warzone last year. He got 6 turn one assaults. He rolled 6. I mean, he rolled, I think it was, he had 14 units that he rolled for. You roll 2, take the highest on all, but he rolled 3, take the highest on 2 of them, and rolled 2, take the highest on like 8, and then just got a couple of random 6s. He has Sentinel, an armored Sentinel that he had, because they have access to those. And the armored Sentinel got a turn one assault off. I'm like, all right, cool. Well, I guess I have to deal with this AV-12 Walker assaulting me on turn one.
I have a life goal to do that to a unit of flesh hounds.
Yeah, exactly, right? Just lock them in combat the rest of the game while they scratch at paint. But it was crazy.
I'm not sure how he did that. They do not have cult ambush, but, close.
They may, because if you have infiltrate, you get cult ambush, right?
Nope. They're two separate rules. Yeah, they're two separate rules.
There's a way to do it. Because we looked at it, and I was like, that's not right. And he was like, no, there is. And we walked it through.
I don't think there's a way to do it, but hey, this is one of those things. The enthusiast, you play in the codex the day it comes out, some things are going to happen. Who cares?
He is
one of the subject matter experts around here for all things Tyranid. And, and I hit the dude up. I'm like, hey, man, what you thinking about?
Paul, they're not Tyranids.
You're right. Sorry, Ricky. You are correct. I was like, hey, what you thinking? Wait, he's like, well, I'm thinking about like 8-9 CADs with 32 psychic dice.
Yup. Yeah, exactly. It's actually funny because I was talking to him about this. I said, well, what impact do you think this is going to have on Warzone? And he basically said, and we kind of, and as the general staff, which is a big gaming club here in Atlanta, we basically kind of came to consensus that it's going to be almost zero impact on Warzone Atlanta. And here's why. It requires an incredibly high number of models to play Gene Stealer Cult. Mm. Great army, great on paper. It's really wonderful. But if you start actually looking at the physical models you have to buy and paint, it is an incredible – I mean, to really run what Paul built or what Colin built or what Price built or what I built, you're talking about 90 to 160 models.
It is
a huge, huge number of toys. And the way those kits came out – and this is no – we're not poo-pooing GW, but the reality of the situation is that if you want certain upgrades that are almost auto-includes for some of the special weapons – you only get one of them per box of 10 or per box of 5. I was talking to Price about this, and he was like, the difficulty that he saw about this for the casual gamer, for any gamer who wants to build a Gene Stealer cult army, is that it's very difficult to get the actual models. There's just tons of them, and the kits don't allow for all of the upgrades that you want.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that the way to actually run these guys is a little bit lean on the war gear, but that's just me, and I could be wrong, and I accept that. I think that if you discount them or the strategy because of that, you will kind of sleep and lose a game. I mean, I think you need to plan on it.
When you summon, those guys are getting free war gear, correct?
They can't. Yeah, when you summon them, they get any war gear that's available to them for the squad.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So like that's where I would see the true dilemma, because I am gonna, like, if I'm to playing Jeet Skiller's Cults or whatever this is, I'm trying to summon a couple things because that's just something else.
Well, the sweet thing is when you summon them, they get the cult ambush roll. They don't deep strike in. Yeah. They cult ambush.
Yeah, they summon via cult ambush.
Yeah, and then rocking that formation that you're talking about. Oh, I came in, I did some work, I lost four guys. Let me.
Return to the shadows.
I'm coming back next turn. I only roll fives and sixes. I don't know what you guys do, but
I do not. I definitely
that's what that's just what you got to do. So I'm coming back with a full strength regeneration of the squad, and you know, then you get to start picking and choosing what, you know, maybe like this guy died with that piece of war gear and stuff like that. So you get to start manipulating how that squad's bringing.
I think this is important to bring out. This is important to point out. I think that it says when you return from the shadows, cold ambush from that the Decurion, you get to replace slain models. So if you were to say you're a little ambitious with your rock cutter or whatever, and it got picked off, you could choose to bring that back. When you summon via the psychic power, you get to choose the war gear on the squad. When you bring back via the rule from the formation, you are only replacing actual slain models from your army.
That's an important distinction, but honestly, and I mean this now, like I said, it's anecdotal. I get that. I'm not the end all be all of experienced players. But it was jarring. I was like, holy smoke, there's kids in the car. I can't say what I want to say. Holy golly jeepers, Batman, what is happening to me? And, you know, save that.
There's been Jeet Stealers, Batman.
Exactly. Save that for the Batcave. I was like, wow, this is bananas. What was going on to me? And it was,
I think it's a great army list simply for the fact of the impact that it has. The decisions that you have to make fighting against it. Your army may not, I'm not saying you tailor armies for it, but the decisions that you have to make are radically different than, you're not just facing a bag of stats. Like, there are a lot of armies out there, and I just look at your stats and I'm like, okay, I know how to combat these stats. But this has a lot of dynamic elements to it that can radically affect that can change over the course of the game.
Well, it pushes you so hard against the rhythm of what a normal 40K game is. You're on your heels the entire time. You're constantly pushing. You're controlling movement. That's the strength behind the Jeet Stealers Cults. And Andrew kind of touched on this, and Paul as well. When you're able to come back, you're able to come back wherever the heck you want. So that is, it's, you're cutting off movement lanes, you're cutting off firing lanes, you're corralling your opponent to wherever you need them, you're putting them in a nice big ball of ooey gooey mess for all of that stuff to keep coming in and wave after wave after wave crashing in and chewing away at your opponent. It's just so much. Like, it just never ends.
It is a lot of models, but to the counter side of that is if you have them broken up into, you know, X amount of units, you're going to roll those, and it doesn't take that many sixes on the cult ambush chart to really kind of swing things in your favor.
Well, it matters a lot because there's no prohibition on multi-assaulting. So for example, I mean, if you've got a 15 or 16 model unit.
Well, remember that the first curse or whatever is the Patriarch and 20 Jeet Stealers. I mean, that's
exactly right. And like those stupid dudes are initiative 6, strength 4 rending, 4 attacks apiece. And one of the games I played against Price, I multi-assaulted. I assaulted that unit, 20 Jeet Stealers with the Primus with 3 units of Sanguinary Guard. And at the end of that combat, yes, I killed all the Jeet Stealers and the Primus, but I had four Sanguinary Guardsmen left. And it was just like, you know, I basically traded 700 points of Space Marines for 380, 400 points of Gene Stealers. And he literally, like, I mean,
that's not where you want to be. That's not the math.
That's not where you want to be. I sold that I reserved to hit all these Gene Stealers, and Price was just, like, cackling with laughter because he's having so much fun. And I, like, we were having a great game, and it was a lot of fun to play with him. But it was like, dude, it was unbelievable to me. I was like, these guys, they swing before me. It's all these rending attacks. You know, even a lot of Death Stars don't want to be dealing with that many attacks, because even at 2+ armor, you know, you want to be schluffing those things off to dogs or whatever.
Yeah, you don't want him getting lucky and killing three of your dudes.
Well, exactly. It's harder to manipulate your bubble wrap of the Death Stars. Like, let's say, you know, we're all familiar with Super Friends. We mostly play it here. So when you have to position your bikes and your dogs and this and that in certain ways, there's no way to really 360 that. You know, you constantly, you're shifting it to where your opponent, where you're moving to your opponent and where his big firing guns are. And then you do a little bit of manipulation if he's got like drop pods or something that comes in that way. But other than that, you're kind of creating like an arc in a way. And now you have to find a way to 360 defend everything. You can't let your priest get charged from the come from the shadows stuff and things like that. You cannot, you have to think about that.
That's a really, really excellent point, Justin, because the reality of the situation is with close combat, you know, a savvy player can really, really have a there are ways to maximize your efficiency with the way you engage models. You know, these four guys are engaged with this unit. These two guys are engaged with this unit. These four guys are engaged with this unit. And so the attacks in a Death Star get split up based on the way that they get engaged. Well, so if I have a Death Star that gets hit by six units of a Gene Stealer cult, the response attacks from the Death Star are defrayed considerably, right? I've got an Iron Priest that is engaged with this stupid unit of hybrids, and you're like, wow, I really wish these strength 10 attacks could be put on that Primus on the other side of this combat, but I can't.
I don't know why, because he's just going to auto-pass all his lookout sirs.
Yeah, don't even matter.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's true, too.
Beat me to it.
Exactly, but like, I mean, you see what my point is, though.
No, I get where you're going. I do, yeah.
The engagements for a savvy assault player really, really take a toll. They're really, really important. It's interesting the way that happens.
Let me give the counterpoint to the Return to the Shadows is kind of in the combination of Cult Ambush. It's two separate rules. So that's very important to point out. It's two separate rules. In the Return to Shadows special rule, it says, instead of moving in your movement phase, any unit with a special rule that is not within 6 inches of an enemy, if any enemy models can be removed from the battlefield and placed ongoing reserves. That's critical, because in the situation that we described earlier where they're like, there's one model left in a unit and you're worried about it coming regenerating, you can essentially lock it down because it has to make that choice in its movement phase where it goes and when it goes into Return of the Shadows. And so there is a possibility of you locking it down, not allowing it to go back into the shadows.
It really,
but in order to do that, you're exposing yourself.
I'm not saying it's Sophie's choice or whatever, you know, it's not it, but there is at least the potential for you to interact with it.
Again, I'm basing my commentary kind of off of a small isolated sample size, but there was numerous occasions in my games now where I've been like, okay, well, I don't want those guys to lurk out, right? They're marked for death. There's only a single model left, whatever it is. And so I can't shoot at it effectively, or maybe I can't assault it, but I can move and turbo boost or run within 6 inches of it just to keep it on the board, because it's not really combat efficient at a single one or two models, but I can keep them from lurking back and disappearing off the board later. And so it's actually a really interesting tactical element for your opponent, or for the opponent of the Gene Stealer cult player, because it's like, well, even if I can't eliminate them, I can still keep them from getting off the board just by being close to them, which again, you know, as we're talking about meta shifting, rewards the player who brings units who are capable of assault, right? If you're a heavy shooty army,
if you're a gun line, you might be in some trouble.
If you're a gun line, or if you have no capacity to get into assault, or if you're worried about getting assaulted by even a three model unit of hybrids, those are all things you have to take into account. But
that's a ton of attacks.
It's 12 attacks. You know, three guys getting into combat on the assault. That's 12 attacks.
I would take that against broad. I'd run that unit into a unit of broadsides. Maybe. I mean, I don't know.
No doubt. I mean, you have to worry about some Overwatch. But I mean, that's three dudes, three three friggin' hybrids is what 25 points worth of models. I'll throw that at some broadsides all day long.
Yeah, I mean, if they make it, they might run them off the table. I mean, it's
exactly. And if they miss it, like, well, too bad.
I guess that was 25 points. Oh well.
Absolutely. So it was just fun. It was a fun dynamic to see how that 6-inch buffer, because they're landing next to you and they're assaulting you. And then if they miss their assaults, or if they get shot out of Overwatch, or if, you know, they sweep you and so on and so forth, like, they're very, very close to you. It was a fun dynamic to see how that interplayed.
Guys, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and talk about some Blood Angels. Going to shift gears a little bit, because helping out our man Adam, who's moving. He's not settled in quite yet. That's why he's not here with us right now. But I was kind of chatting with him about an army list, and I want to talk about this Blood Angel new sweet Angel's Blade tech on the show. And then we'll get in very briefly, and then we'll talk about the finishing moves, which will be very, I guess, appropriate talking about squad markings. I think this is going to be incredibly important as the game continues to evolve. Anyway, see you guys.
Did someone say Blood Angels?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
FTN is brought to you by Bell of Lost Souls. Check out www.bols.org for the best daily hobby articles on the web.
Hey everybody, we are back. I'm TPM. I got Andrew Whitaker and Justin Troop.
Hey homies.
I got an arm growing out of my side.
Chris Morgan and Ricky Addington.
With a...
I love Age of Sigmar.
I knew you were going to say
your FTN therapy hour.
Couldn't get through it. Couldn't get through an hour.
Couldn't make it.
I want to talk briefly about the White Dwarf this month. It is awesome. This is the second magazine after the reboot, and it is great. I mean, there's probably like 10 painting tutorials in this thing.
At least 13. Yeah.
It's a bunch. I'm with you. They're hidden. Like, so in some of the Army Exposé, they've got a couple paint tutorials. And the paint splatter itself goes through painting faces, painting black armor, painting red armor, things that are very relevant to my interests. And it's some Blood Angel stuff. I mean, it's great.
Oh, yeah. It's such a high-quality magazine, too. When you're looking at it and you're holding it and you're feeling it, the texture changes. Like, there's, like, super high gloss. Then there's, like, a matte portion and all this stuff. Like, this is, like... It's not just a standard magazine anymore. Like, this is some next level, really thought out things. And I'm going to put this on my coffee table just because it looks cool.
It's actually funny you say that, Troop, because I was entertained. So my fiance, Emily, her parents, so my future in-laws, came over to my apartment, I guess last week. We were in my living room. We were, you know, having drinks. It was her sister, so my future sister-in-law and her husband and like my future in-laws. It was like... probably like half a dozen of us or so in my apartment, and like on my coffee table is the most recent issue of White Dwarf. I have my issue of White Dwarf next to like the same issue of Garden and Gun. And so, and my future mother-in-law picks up my White Dwarf magazine and starts thumbing through it. Cause you know, it's just coffee table material. We're shooting the bull and like having cocktails or whatever on a Saturday night. And she's like, "What is this magazine? It looks very nice." And she just says that very innocuously. It's like thumbing through it. And then there's like this picture of like Karn the Betrayer, like probably like on page 6.
In blood.
Just like just soaked in blood, chopping through some guardsmen. And she's like, "What is this magazine? What is going on here?" And I was like, "Oh, well, that's White Dwarf, ma'am. And it's kind of my favorite magazine."
I feel like you got caught with the Playboy, like when you're in junior high.
Exactly. That,
right. Like, awkward moment where you have to explain yourself.
Well, how long have you known them?
I mean, yeah,
in this most recent episode or issue, there's a big expose on Jess Goodwin, and hearing him hear his thoughts on the full, he's as much a part of the Warhammer universe as John Blanche, any of the rules writers, any of the original rules designers. I think, I mean, just an icon for us Warhammer players, and he has a really good, what I would say, candid interview in this magazine. It was really fun to read for me. Right? He's brilliant, a master sculptor, and the way that he can capture the 40K feel and like that John Blanche artwork in his miniatures. Anyway, he talks a little about that in the magazine. So if you haven't picked up a recent copy of this after it changed from the weekly to the monthly format, I really suggest it. I mean, there's a lot of, it's entertaining. It's not the previous White Dwarfs before they went to the weekly format got more like real catalog-y. Like it's hey, look at our miniatures, buy them or whatever. This displays them in a very conversational manner. It's really cool. I definitely just suggest checking it out.
Yeah, you definitely get more. Is readability a word, Chris? I feel like, you know, you get more out of it.
Readability is definitely a word.
Boom. But if it's not, it is now.
Not the one you're looking for.
In the Urban Dictionary.
Yeah, we'll make that a word. But it's like, you know, you get more out of it. You sit down and you actually can get something out of it. You have something to read instead of just like, oh, wow, here's next week's releases that I already saw on Bell Lost Souls, you know, 2 hours ago. So why am I paying for the magazine? So I like it a lot more. I think I made the joke.
It's got more meat on the bone.
Yeah, it's jam-packed. I mean, yeah. Even just the tutorials, and this is a new age of tutorials where they're not skipping steps.
You remember years ago, it was like that. Have you ever seen that comic where it's like how to draw an owl and it shows drawing two circles and it's draw the rest of the effing owl, you know? And that's like – that's what those old tutorials were like. And now it's like they actually, you know, teach you something. It's like, oh my God, this is quality.
Right. So our man Adam is in Canby here. He's transitioning, but I want to talk about him because he was just kicking around. He wants to do a hobby project that focuses on, you know, kind of his painting talent. And he's an amazing painter. Check out his commission studio. I mean, he's one of the best miniature painters that you're going to encounter in this hobby right now. And he hit me with, he wants to play much Dreadnoughts and Stormer. He likes Flyers and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I'll help you. This list is cool. It's fun. But man, it got me thinking about how could I tear somebody's head off with some of the new Blood Angel stuff? And this is
an excellent question to ask yourself.
Right. So, you know, and following back to Justin's point from a couple of weeks ago, you know, where we talked a lot about the Golden Host, and the Golden Host is awesome. But the Terminator, the Orbital Intervention Force is also very strong. And then there's been a bunch of debate recently on the internet because the way the Archangel Orbital Intervention Force works is that they're in the formation, their rules are broken up into two separate rules. The rule is they get to all go into deep strike and all make one roll and all come down together. And the second rule is, the second entry is when they enter the game via deep strike reserves, they get to assault. So people have been proposing that you can put them in drop pods and bring them in. Go ahead.
Yeah, man, you know, so gamers are going to game, right? So this is the way.
This is beautiful. This is not me disparaging. I built the list based off this simple talk.
So Golden Host gets to come in turn one, correct?
No, you can choose starting on turn two.
Okay, so I'm confused on that part. All right, so giving these guys the option instead. So you're weighing these two guys.
Let me go through the list before you get into all the tactics, I guess. And this is not optimized. This is simply me going, cool, your hobby list sounds amazing. You're going to paint it up like a freaking champion. Let me put together something that I might try to win a tournament with. And so starts out with the Archangel's Intervention Force detachment, and then the Ancients detachment with three Librarian Dreadnoughts and Lucius pods, and then going and bringing out the Flesh Terror Strike Force out of the mothballs, because you get to then pick up the discount pods, and I mean discount is a tax. Is short for that, or is lean for that. So in this
Gabriel
case,
Seth is giving out free hugs with those nowadays.
Yeah, a firm handshake from Seth when you purchase his pods. But there's a Librarian and then a unit of Stern Guard in the elite slot. Now look, the Stern Guard, completely superfluous. I happen to have painted up a 10-man unit of Stern Guard that I've never actually put on the table that I keep trying to find an excuse for. I thought this would be just as good as any, but feel free, you know, if you're experimenting with this, understand that is not what I mean. I'm not endorsing the Stern Guard. I'm simply saying they're in this list because I would like to put them on the table. And then you go to the troop section because you have to take a troop with the Flesh Terror Strike Force. Caster of the Damned is a troop slot, a troop choice.
Yep.
And he's no slouch.
He will, when he touches you, he will not touch you in the friendly kind of fashion.
Yeah, that extra two attacks, man, just shreds. It
with that, isn't he so five base? He's like with the extra attacks.
He's five base, plus one for two close combat weapons, plus two on the charge. So he's eight attacks on the charge.
No big deal.
NBD. NBD. Eight strength 10 attacks, rerolling to wound.
Yeah.
On the charge. Not a big
deal. That's called a mollywop where I come
from. Yes.
Exactly. I cannot vouch for that word, but I like the way it sounds.
So then,
it's real. Yes.
Then you pick up a couple of just random pods. So the Stern Guard get a pod, Caster gets a pod, two random drop pods. So not all in my current configuration, 1845, again, with the Stern Guard, this is not optimized. So again, don't take this as the gospel, but the concept I think is incredibly strong and worth tooling up to whatever it is that you feel like playing with, because coming with the ability to bring in those Terminators, you have to bring in some pods turn one, right? And this list lets you choose which pod you bring in, of course. So sometimes you're going to want to bring in the Dreads, kind of out of reach. Maybe they harry some people with the psychic attacks, or sometimes you're just going to want to beat people up with these Terminators.
So I want to beat people up every time with the Terminators.
Yeah.
If that's in my head. If I'm not charging, I'm not happy. But that's just my brain. And don't, well, you know, call me kooky.
The meta is shifting. It has, I think it has fully shifted a considerable amount back toward assault-centric armies because of a large number of units that can now assault out of reserve. There's Chaos Marines that can assault out of reserve. There's regular Space Marine units that can assault out of reserve. There's Blood Angels units. There's Gene Stealer Cult. Basically, as it is now, you have to bring some kind of capacity to deal with heavy assault armies. The age of the gun line is over. And I think that, again, I don't want to quote myself as being the Nostradamus of 40K that I am, but I said, you know, jet bikes are dead. Because jet bikes don't deal with getting assaulted very, very well. They're just not great at getting assaulted. Wait,
they're not good at beating down five Terminators with Thunderhammer Storm Shields.
Shockingly.
There's only so many things you can do with the carrot in close combat.
Or, exactly, or Caster right. The Damned.
and that's the reality. Whether you're getting hit by Raptors or, you know, regular old assault marines in a Skyhammer, it doesn't matter. Jet bikes don't react well to chainswords.
I see what you did there.
Thank you, Morgan. I appreciate that little tip of the hat. So that's a big deal. And so I say all that by way of mentioning. So Paul has said, okay, I can bring in these Terminators on turn one and assault out of my pods. Assaulting out of pods is even better than assaulting out of Deep Strike because pods are much more stable in terms of
less prone to mishaps.
Less prone to mishap. And two, I can deploy out of a pod and then get at max coherency. So even if you have Interceptor with, say, Riptides with the big pie plate, you're not going to get as many guys as opposed to a Deep Strike where I'm clustered up. If you have an Interceptor with a Riptide, you know, at strength 8 AP2, you can really hurt Terminators that way. If I get out of a pod and I deploy out 6 inches out of that pod, you know, you're not going to get all five guys in my unit. You're going to get maybe one or two, depending on your scatter. Best case scenario. That's not to be taken for granted. That's number one. Number two, because of all of these, all of the capacity now to assault, it's going to force list building decisions for armies that don't have assault capacity. Gunline Tau, you know, Warp Spider Spam, Jet Bike Spam Eldar, a lot of Imperial Guard armies. Gladius is another really good one. I mean, Gladius doesn't really have a good answer for getting assaulted turn one out of reserve. I mean, if I deploy my Thunderhammer Storm Shield Terminators out of a drop pod, two squads of them, and multi-assault five Rhinos, that spells kind of certain doom for most Gladius armies.
Because 10 all Terminators will beat down 30 Tag Marines.
Absolutely. The Tag Marines don't have the capacity to kill one turn of shooting. I'm gonna land, I'm gonna assault, I'm gonna blow up all of your Rhinos. And now you're gonna have one turn of shooting to kill 10 Terminators or 15 Terminators.
Yeah.
And if you don't kill them, which math says you're not gonna kill them, they're going to chew through you.
Man, I had a lot of success. We talked about this, but even just that one Space Wolf Terminator in a unit of Grey Hunters or whatever, it made all the difference in some situations. So now you're able to effectively place, you know, 15 plus Terminators. I mean, it's something people are going to have to deal with.
I mean,
it's huge, man. I love this formation. Like this one is like the game changer for me personally.
So to me, I think that Golden Host and Chapter Ancients are the two strongest formations out of Angel's Blade.
I like the options of Golden Host, not having to deploy to be a deep strike, being able to get Dante. I think those are huge.
I think you may want to reread the Golden Host because I believe you do have to deploy via deep strike, and maybe the language there is it's a little funky.
I'll go look it up.
But I think you must deploy via deep strike, so there's a little less flexibility there. But all the same, it's a very cheap way to get a Lord of War in Dante. It's assault out of deep strike. It's precision scatter. I mean, rerolling your scatter is massive.
Yeah.
And one thing that's very often overlooked, especially with the Golden Host with the Sanguinary Guard, is AP4 bolters. You know.
Well, and now with Gene Stealers too, because you remember bullets kill these stupid little guys, right?
Exactly.
I think that sets these guys up better than the Thunderhammer Storm Shields in that context.
My B, it says all units in the formation must arrive either the same turn and all must deep strike onto the battlefield.
Yes.
You are correct. So, that is written differently than it is in other formations. I apologize for missing it.
I think it's a little buried, which is why it's easily overlooked. But you do have to deploy via deep strike. But it's still one of the situations where I get to choose which turn I come in on, which is really, really nice.
And you don't have to choose before the game starts either.
Exactly. I mean, for me, I believe that, and this is kind of one of those things. So a regular drop pod is 35 points. A Lucius drop pod is 50 points. In my mind, if you are deploying dreadnoughts via drop pod,
Lucius,
there is almost no reason. I cannot conceive of a reason why, other than I just don't have the models. I can't conceive of a gameplay reason why you would not spend the 15 points to get a Lucius pod.
The functionality is strong. And this list we're talking about right now has four of them, and the three librarian dreadnoughts and then Kassor. All
exactly.
And that's one thing that you know, bears mentioning, even in the 30K context, they recently repointed those to be 100 points because of how well people were using them. So enjoy it while you got it, folks.
Yeah, completely agree. So the thing that attracted me to this list was that it's 100% Blood Angels, which is appealing to some people. I mean, me included, sometimes allying in. It does.
You can say my name, Paul. It's okay.
Appealing to one person on the show who just plays Blood Angels. but I think it's strong. I mean, and this kind of checked all the boxes for me. It's like, okay, there's a hobby element here, which is what I was originally talking about with our man Adam. And then there's an aggression element here because of all the options of being able to assault or come out of the pod after you arrive. You know, there's some play here. And then again, it's Blood Angels. So, you know, checked all the boxes.
Hey, I love what you got here. I already know what Adam's list is going to be. It's going to have a Storm Raven because he likes to paint flying stuff. He should have been a pilot. You know, what's with the bike thing? Be a pilot, Adam. He's going to have bikes because he has to have bikes. It's Adam. That's his thing. He's going to paint up everything that the book has to offer.
With wings.
Yeah,
let's clarify here, though. We got to point out he's going to paint these as Lamenters, right?
So, full disclosure, like, he's painting, like, this army that he's painted, this Lamenter's army is going to be mine, right? Like, I'm bankrolling this. And so, like, it's going to be, there's going to be no Storm Ravens because that's not going to happen. I'm not
seeing the list. There's going to be a Storm Raven.
Like,
Just keep telling him. Oh, it's in the mail. I got it.
Exactly.
It hasn't arrived yet.
Low key, I'm not paying for a Storm Raven, but I will pay for a lot of this other stuff. I think Angel's Blade got the internet passed judgment on it in about 72 hours.
The internet doesn't do that, Andrew. That's silly.
Oh,
ever.
It's more like 12.
12 seconds.
12 seconds, exactly. And the internet passed judgment on it, and the overall internet opinion was three letters, M-E-H, meh. Like, whatever. It's meh. It's not that
well,
good.
Well, that's everything now. If it doesn't give you free transports for everything, it's
and
no
objective
good.
Objective secured on
it. It's crap. It's crap. But
right. Largely got the same treatment as Traitor's Hate, and it was like, No.
Which is good.
Traitor's Hate is very good. Angel's Blade is very good. We should dial back the lack of enthusiasm considerably because what Paul just talked about is a great option. Golden Host is phenomenal. Chapter Ancients.
Paul created a list with Librarian Dreadnoughts in it. That should be very telling to people.
It's a big moment.
I'm not going to say that Paul stole that from me.
Quickening Force.
BTC list. Yeah. Can I say that? I'm not going to say that he's going to edit that out. I'm just saying.
I'm not editing this show.
It's very good. It's very, very good. There's lots of great options in it.
Guys, get it all out.
And I will say this. I've played Chapter Ancients now That's I'm bringing that list to Warzone. Chapter Ancients is part of my Warzone list. And the turn, so I assaulted, and then I declared my Chapter Ancients rule, where, like, this is the turn that I get to do. And I got to pile in, and in my movement phase, I assaulted, I didn't kill the whole unit with the three dreadnoughts that I assaulted with. And then I declared that, all right, so in the subsequent movement phase, in my opponent's turn, I killed all but, like, you know, you get a free round of combat in which your opponent does not get to participate. And it was vanquishing. It was wonderful. It was so powerful.
It's a strong rule. And
so huge.
You need to
do that only in your turn. You have to, at the start of any Blood Angel's turn, it says right here.
That's right. So I apologize for I mischaracterized it. It was in my turn, declared it. I killed my opponent. I finished the combat in my movement phase, consolidated, and then got to assault later in the same turn. It was harkened back to
that has value.
The third edition glory, where it was like I got to consolidate into another combat. Except in this one, I got to kill you in my movement phase and then assault a different unit in my assault phase. It was great.
Did you get
free objective secured rhinos, Andrew? No, you didn't. So it's meh.
He got them for his dreadnoughts.
This is the kind of stuff that gave me.
They use them like skateboards.
In both of these segments, we've talked about list building, and I love doing that. I love cracking open a book and just kind of seeing what could happen. And this is all based on crosstalk. You know, it's like, oh, getting a little bit from these insights, a little bit from that insights, and then putting these lists together that to me seem kind of fun to play. And then with my own hobby element, you know, I don't want to make it sound like I'm down talking the hobby side of it. Like, I really liked the way my Stern Guard looked, and I wanted to put them into a list. I'm like, huh, let me, my librarian from the Flesh Terrors can roll with these Stern Guard, and it's not even wasted. Like, they could actually do something in this list that makes it a viable choice. So it's kind of fun.
No doubt.
So let's go into the finishing move segment. The finishing moves I want to talk about this week is squad markings. Squad markings, especially with the things that we're talking about with like the Gene Stealer cult or the Cult Mechanicus or even Marines, like being able to not get yourself into like sticky situations, being able to explain what your units are with your units is huge. This segment is sponsored by Raging Heroes. Raging Heroes saw my AdMech army on Twitter and is like, hey, could we be a part of the show? I'm like, absolutely. So the Toughest Girls in the Galaxy, if you guys aren't familiar with that Kickstarter, I actually bought into that Kickstarter, but they sent me the Iron Empire Necro Priestess, which has an absolute amazing Dark Mechanicus feel to it, to me.
So cool.
Check it out at, it's at RagingHeroes.com. They have an impressive line of female, like, sci-fi troopers and stuff. And I actually got the Jailbirds during the Kickstarter because they kind of blend in my opinion, pretty well with my Catechins. And so since I've had that army for, you know, a decade and a half now or whatever, I wanted to kind of mix it up with some interesting figures. Anyway, they saw my AdMech, which hopefully you guys are familiar with the Blue Weathered. And like, hey, this would fit in. Like, hey, I agree. And so now they're the sponsor of this particular segment this week, and can't thank them enough. They're actually going to be a sponsor for Warzone Atlanta as well, kicking in some prize support.
Yeah, I think I was joking with Justin about how, like, this is the worst. I hate going to this website because every time I go to the website, it makes me want to build an entire army just to put one of these models in. This, like, General Ilsa Wolfenstein, that I'm already coming up with an army for that model. It looks like a commissar with lightning claws. I need that in my life. I don't even care what the army is, but it's going in there somewhere.
What's the website for the listeners?
RagingHeroes.com is the website.
Yeah, some of the most amazing sculpts. Like, the designers for there are just phenomenal. Like, these guys are like, I'm talking like Games Workshop quality sculpts. You know, they're on par with that, with the level of detail, the design and stuff. I physically haven't got to hold a model yet, and I can't wait to be able to. But they just, you know, I see all the digital renders and stuff. What the mind that they have and the vision that they have creating some of these things are just insane.
This model is crisp sculpt. It's, I mean, great detail. I cannot wait to get it painted up and on the figure or on the table. It's, again, it's something new. I mean, like, for me, the particular army that I'm talking about, the character models are there's kind of like one great character model, and the rest of them are just kind of, I mean, they're awesome, but they do kind of blend in, I think, with the rest of the army. This is another one. This one here from Raging Heroes really stands out, which is what you want from your character models. And so definitely check them out. And so the Finishing Move segment this week is going to be about squad markings. Squad markings are one of these things that you can really do to kind of jump up your painting game, and they're not as intimidating as it may sound. And one of the takeaways I want to have from this segment is that every single army out there has some feature on it that you can use to highlight, accentuate, or draw attention to a specific unit or squad in your army.
You said that, it's to step up your hobby and stuff like that. And you have to mention before we start delving into the cool tech and stuff, but this not only does it step up your hobby, it steps up your tournament, because you get scored based off of squad markings in a lot of painting rubrics out there. So this is something that if you're looking to start competing a little bit more in that painted section, this is a free, easy point or two or whatever, you know, they weighed it as. But this is one that you need to jump on, because it makes everything that much better.
Yeah, it just makes all your models look like they belong somewhere too. I mean, it's, you know, especially when you're, oh God, if you're doing Gladius or Lion's Blade, because I've got a Lion's Blade, and after you've painted 50 Marines, man, you really got to do something to make them kind of look a little different from each other. So, and you definitely want to be able to tell where they belong on the battlefield. So
yeah,
squad markings are key.
Practically speaking, I will say it's squad markings is something that, from an organizational standpoint, will help you move things on the table more efficiently and keep track of, you know, especially in close combat, things like that, knowing who has what special rules as per whatever detachment they're in. There's a lot of utility that goes into squad markings.
I will say, though, it is one of the most difficult things in 40K. Because it's where it's kind of squad markings are at the it exists in the crossroads between the hobby and the tabletop. When I'm painting a squad of Vestroian Imperial Guardsmen, you know, I want my squad to match the army theme, and that's part of the aesthetic of painting. But functionally, a la Chris's point, it behooves me to have these guys different and distinct so that it helps my game along rapidly. And that's a very difficult thing to kind of come to balance with, because, you know, I want, for example, Imperial Guard are a great example, because it's like, okay, I've got a 50-man platoon, right? And I've got five different 10-man squads.
Like, you're just pulling out 50 guys.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm pulling out of my foam, and it's like, all right, I got 50 guys here. Very, very difficult to go from, okay, these 10 guys, now they're all one platoon. And then the next game, now they're all five different squads. And in the next game, now they're all veterans, so they're not at all part of the same platoon. And in the next game, I'm never going to break them up, and they're all going to run one 50-man unit. All of those things are very difficult to achieve, because as soon as you paint them with different colored hats or, you know, different colored war gear or whatever it is, whatever you choose to denote them within their particular squads with their squad markings, it feels very permanent. And so it's very, very difficult to on the one hand,
let me simplify this just a little bit. I think that at the heart of the squad markings, you are, well, one, it's a hobby thing, but then you're really just communicating to your opponent. It's a form of easy communication. So when things get kind of sticky, like in an assault, or which one of these dudes is OPSEC and which isn't, which one of these guys gets Furious Charging and who doesn't, you're able to easily, effectively communicate with your opponent.
Yeah, and that's like the advantages to squad markings are exactly what Paul just said, easy communication. The shortcoming and the difficulty comes from this game, this squad has these things. The next game, they may not have those things.
Well, I think IG is the only one that actually suffers from that, though, because everybody else, you build 10-man squad of this, and that's that, you know? Like,
well, I think even Space Marines can run into that, too, because, you know, like mine, you know, I've got all my guys are painted up as a third company of the Dark Angels, and all my tactical squads, third number, they've got their tactical squad markings, they've got their squad numbers on them, all that, which it looks great while I've got them there, but it's like Andrew said, as soon as I want to switch, you know, switch that guy out and put him in a Devastator squad, all of a sudden his markings don't match, and then it kind of kills the whole thing.
I still think of that. That is a your problem. I think that when you're painting squad markings, you're getting those points for the tournament, like we pointed out a little bit earlier, and you're making it much easier. You're creating a much better sporting situation with your opponent. So let's talk about like how you do it. So how do you get the squad markings on figures?
Paint. Boom.
Decals.
Well, that's another option. Yeah. So paint and decals, obviously very like easy. I don't want to say it's trivial. It's easy to do. There are things, the decals nowadays are way better than they used to be.
Oh, absolutely.
And they're plentiful.
Yeah, and you can get them anywhere. Gosh, I mean, every event you go to now, you're going to get a coupon from something for some decal place. Now I've got like three of them on my little hobby right here. They're everywhere, and
you can even make your own quality printer.
My Deathwing army, I made my own banner, printed it off and onto water transfer, you know, an actual decal, and slid it right on there. And you can do that with squad markings. You can make your own. You can do whatever you want. But I mean, if you're fortunate enough to be playing an army that comes with a decal sheet, boom, you know, there you go. You're done.
It's pretty easy with either a numeral or one of the symbols that are on the decal sheet to use that. And to Chris's point with paint, I want to talk about like hand painting stuff on models. I am incredibly intimidated from painting any kind of freehand on a model.
Oh, yeah. That's terrifying.
I practice, and I look at, like, especially nowadays, you look on any professional paintings or like figure painter magazine's Facebook page or whatever, and you see someone like has painted this mural of Kairos Fate Weaver on a thumbnail, like on like literally the space the size of someone's thumbnail, and you're like, I give up.
I hate those guys because it's like, you're amazing. I'll never be as good as you. I already resigned myself to never being a fraction of this talent.
But
I feel like you're doing so well and then you go to mediocrity.
But let's talk about it though. For as far as like squad markings go, okay, with a piece of armor or whatever, you don't necessarily have to paint a freehand number or a letter or anything or a grail or a winged skull. Like, you don't have to do any of that. A simple geometric shape might be enough for you to differentiate your squads. And it's not that necessarily difficult to do. Even in the most recent White Dwarf, they talk about how to paint tattoos on like Gene Stealer heads. And the GW way of doing it is, I don't know. I can't do it. I'm not good at it. I'm the decal guy. I'm going to put decals on and hopefully that gets me through the thing or sculpted shoulder pads. Like I'm going to harvest from eBay or the sprues from all my friends, the particular shoulder pad that I need. That's also a way to get you the squad markings. But the Games Workshop way of painting, you know, geometric shapes on things, plotting out with dots. And then basically just playing connect the dots with your paint is also a way to mark your squads.
And another kind of little cheat that you can do or some, you know, secret tech is get a soft, like a 0.5 millimeter lead pencil, mechanical lead pencil, get the soft lead of it, and you can lightly brush that lead over the model and get your kind of an outline. So instead of just doing a simple geometric shape, you might be able to add a little bit more dynamic. So you're not connecting the dots, but you have a small outline to go off of. Now it's just paint by numbers.
Taking the skill out of your paintbrush and putting it in your pencil, and then you're tracing essentially at that point.
Yeah. You know, you still definitely need a super fine brush, and you still need, you know, super thin paints, and make sure you twist your brush. Otherwise, Duncan will come and steal your blanket while you're sleeping.
He did that to me the other day. It was tragic.
He's the Krumpus of bad painting.
Great reference.
But like with like Verstrarians or like with these Gene Stealer cults and stuff, like I want to point out that there are ways on even those models that don't have readily available armor plates maybe or blank wide open spaces to paint to count as squad markings. Like for instance, these new cult models have a bunch of flashlights on their shoulders or whatever. You could have different color lights in those shoulder areas or any spotlights or whatever.
They just got out of a disco party.
But that's a way, again, you're communicating with the opponent what those squads are.
Or you could paint their nails, you know?
That's another thing. Like we're leading into what I've been wanting to talk about, which is how to deal with organic Xenos armies. And you know, with a Tyranid army, for example, having all the armor plates or having different squads of Termagants with different colors of armor or skin color doesn't look uniform very well. But some things you can do is pick complementary colors to your main scheme and alternate things like eye color. Or we talked in our last recording, we talked about, to Troop's point, nails and claws that are painted different. Or maybe, you know, maybe this squad has red blood on their claws. This one has blue blood or green blood or whatever. There are things you can do that are characterful that won't sacrifice the unity of your organic themed army. And
it's subtle for them. Yeah. Like for their specific case, you're going to want everything to be subtle.
Yeah. Yep. Model the skin here, maybe give them some stripes on their skin here, something. I mean, I've played armies before where I didn't even notice the difference until my buddy pointed out, that he had done the carapace a little differently here. And he knew, and I didn't pay much attention to it until he pointed it out. So, you know, nice subtle like that. And then when you ask a question, they can easily identify it for you. That I like that, as you know, when my opponent can tell me, yeah, this one's this, 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 and this, and then he can point out why. That's exactly what you want out of it.
Kind of stuff that has a game playable, translatable effect that isn't necessarily that hard to accomplish with. So I think the big major things are find something on the model that is easy for you to manipulate that gives you that advantage to get the squad markings. And I think that as we see more and more complex formations and complex army lists, that is going to be critically important to avoid some kind of sticky situation. So you've got a sportsmanship issue, and I shouldn't say issue. Issue is a strong word. You have a potential sportsmanship concern, and then some painting room concern if you're using this competitively. I mean, those are big things.
Yeah, and for those real subtle effects, especially if you're going for those extra points, be around to point them out to the judge, because as with anything, Ricky was saying readability earlier, there's a visual readability in differentiating between similar looking models that if it's too subtle, the eye just kind of glazes over it. So, you know, make sure you give yourself credit for that work.
And then if you're not worried, I mean, you know, and then we got on the low tech side of it too, is, you know, if you're not going for that, just, man, get a little sticker and put on your base on the back.
The low tech side is something we should talk about too. I mean, in years
color
past,
the rings.
I have painted a terrible Roman numerals on the bottom of my bases. And in some situations, I've just put a dot on the back of the base to differentiate between the units. If they weren't painted separately, you know, I like all my stuff to look like it came on the same bus, you know, so that means a little bit of uniformity between the different squads. And so it's difficult sometimes to work this in. And on the incredibly low tech side, putting just a dot of paint of a specific color for the squad on the very back of the base doesn't disrupt the aesthetic from your opponent's view. It allows you to put you in very defensible positions where it's, where you're having to say this unit's assaulting here or I have one man left over from this obtech squad and, or whatever, you know, it's a real good indicator of what's going on the tabletop.
Honestly, like squad markings are, in my opinion, one of the most difficult choices a hobbyist has to make. I've always felt this incredible sense of frustration with it because to me, I'm like, okay, I've got these in some of my games. I physically own, Andrew Whitaker personally owns, say, 40 Blood Angels tactical Marines that are painted. Okay, cool. That's a ton. That's way more than most people. 40 fully painted tactical Marines. Okay, great. Well, say I want to run 2 10-man squads and 2 5-man squads. Well, to paint those, and I want to take them to a tournament and get my full max rubric of painting scores with squad markings. Well, in this particular event, it's difficult to do that because I'm thinking to myself, well, these 10 guys are all going to have, I don't know, white shoulder pads on their left shoulder. And then as soon as I go to the next tournament and I want to run, instead of 2 10-mans and 2 5-mans, I want to run 6 5-mans. Same total number of Marines, totally different squad marks. Very, very logistically difficult to paint that and to make sure that they come across. Because if I take those exact same physical models and go from 2 10-mans, 2 5-mans to now 6 5-mans, same total number of models, but now I've got 20 guys with white shoulder pads. And those are that's no longer functionally efficient squad marks. That's
the answer is to have 60.
Yeah, Marines. That's it. Just 60 yeah. Marines.
That's it. That's your answer. 60 Marines.
Yeah. So, yeah. So there's the finishing move is you have to paint 20 more Marines.
Yeah. That's double honestly other. That's honestly what I hear a lot of the times when people are like, all right, you know, you don't have squad markings, therefore I'm going to mark you down. I'm like, well.
Well, I want to talk less on the actual rubric scoring and just how this is something that the normal person can do. Like, it is not intimidating to do. There are things that you can actually do on the whatever your skill level is to complete this function and to make it look make your army look a little bit better.
It is better to do the temporary squad marks than it is. I mean, if I'm going to a tournament, for example, I will put dots on the back of my bases. I'll put a single dot per squad because I know, all right, it's not a permanent mark on my models. I don't have to repaint the whole left shoulder pad of my Marines. You know, this squad has a single dot. This squad has 2 dots. This squad has 3 dots.
That's okay. Acceptable. I mean, that really is acceptable. That is something that you could, again, because you're still being able to communicate with your opponent. And if you're not going for points, I mean, this is one of those things that has a dual function. There's painting points, there's aesthetics, and then there's just functionality on the table.
And that's, I guess, ultimately, squad markings are a form of functionality. And if you do the whole, all right, these guys have marks on the bottom of their bases or their back left foot has some kind of different color stripe or something like that. At the end of the day, all right, now I've gotten home at the end of this GT. It was great. I lost to Ricky Addington in the finals, so be it.
No, you didn't.
You know what? I can now take a single brush stroke and remove that squad mark. I took a single white dot and put it on the bottom of my base, and now I just dab in black and cover that up, and it goes away. So you can mix that functionality on a temporary basis if that's what you're going for. Going into a tournament. And for me, that has always been the biggest thing because I don't have the time to paint 70 Marines. I only have 40, and those 40 have to come in every single conceivable combination of 5-man squads, 10-man squads, tactical Marines versus Stern Guard or whatever it is. I don't have, you know, a lot of people just don't have the resources or the time.
I think what you're saying is perfectly acceptable, and that is something that we should consider for the scope of this segment. But I want to really translate that this is not – squad marking your army is not as intimidating as it sounds. And there are ways there are ways to accomplish this that at the very high-tech level, freehand painting.
If you've never done squad markings on your models, you know, before, don't be intimidated. And it really brings your army together when you know, because, you know, when you start, like me personally, when I start building my army and I get into it and I start coming up, you know, every time you paint them, you start coming up with cool ideas about who this guy was and everything. And when you start putting those squad markings on there, you take more ownership of them. Yeah, it sucks when you want to, you know, move that model to a different squad, but it's not difficult to sit down and, take a water transfer and slide it on there and just go that little extra step, or to paint a shoulder pad in a specific way, or to put a stripe on your jet bikes in a specific way, so that you can easily identify them and it makes them look better on the table. Just
you can spend 10 extra minutes per guy and then you've got a better figure, in my opinion, that accomplishes many goals. Well, guys,
I hate bare shoulder pads.
Yeah, thanks a lot for talking to me about this stuff tonight. Anybody else want to kick in any tips before we get out of here?
Ricky, would you give us the lowdown on your tournament that you're going to come up with? We're on our way out. We're 5 weeks out from Warzone.
Oh, so, yeah. 2 weeks out from mine. Yeah. So October 22nd, it is in Gate City, Virginia, which is it sounds like it's in the middle of nowhere, but It's because it is.
It doesn't sound like it. It is.
It really is. But we have our gaming club there, and we have about 2,800 square feet of gaming space, and we just started the club up and everything. So we got eight tables there ready to go, and I got guys on standby. So as soon as I have more than 16 people commit, we're starting to build tables to expand that out. So we're running a Warzone Atlanta prep tournament. So all the rules, if you can do it at Warzone, you're going to do it here. And we're pretty excited to do it. We're not turning any profit on it. So we're given, I believe it'll be 125% of all everything we take in is going back out to prize support. So we're trying to prize as heavily as we can on that and basically just have a good weekend.
That's awesome. I think Andrew and I are going to
two mountain ranges between me and that event.
I think Andrew and I are going to try to kick it up there, but you know, we'll certainly keep you guys posted if we're going to be in attendance.
I think there's a big chunk of Atlantic guys coming up, so that'll be fun.
Yeah. And just hit me up on Facebook or something. If you want information about it, we've got the event up on Facebook. If you are planning on going, do me a favor, just click that you're interested or going so we can kind of get a good thing. Because
you
got to
paint 10 more buildings.
I got to paint 10 more tables of terrain to get ready. Just because it's such a small town, even if you need to find a hotel, I've already been helping a couple of guys finding a hotel to stay at and everything. And so just let us know what you need for you to have a good experience when you come up to Gate City, and we'll get y'all taken care of.
I cannot thank y'all enough for taking time out of your weekend day to come and record this show with me. I'm going to get it up as soon as possible. You guys have a good rest of y'all's night.
Good night, team. Thanks for listening, guys.
Bye-bye.